We'll begin with the first case, which is 20-3149 Santucci versus Commandant. You're muted, Mr. Maher.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm much obliged. And John Maher, on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Anthony Santucci, good morning to you, Justice Holmes and Justice Eade and Justice Ebel. Good morning to you, Mr. Mogg, Counsel for the United States. And I'd like to begin with just a brief orientation of the facts. This is the case where a brand new soldier to the Army, 21 years old, only been in for 2 years, no previous criminal record, went to a bar in Fort Polk, Louisiana, and claimed and took the stand and defended himself against allegations of rape that they had consensual sex. The challenge, though, is there are at least 9 reasons why the Article I Military Tribunal did not provide full or fair or adequate consideration. And I would like to go through them if that's okay, because that's a real crux of the case from the appellant's point of view. That is, number one, the lower court, the Article I Military Tribunal, found
before you get into the facts, are we all in agreement that the test is the Dodson test, and what we're really focusing on is the fourth prong of the Dodson test?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then we're all together on the same law. Proceed then.
Yes, sir. Thank you very kindly, Your Honor. And the lower court, meaning the Article I Military Tribunal, found 2 constitutional instructional mistakes of constitutional magnitude that the mistake of fact instruction should have issued, but was not. And then secondly, that the propensity instruction, where charged misconduct was being able to use to prove other charged misconduct, meaning the accused was presumed innocent of both of those charges. That is flatly unconstitutional. It's well-settled law.
Mr. Maher, I don't want to get you too far off track, but on the mistake of fact argument, yes, was Judge, that in fact raised before the court of appeals of armed forces? And if so, where in the record would it show that that is the case?
Yes, Your Honor, it was raised before the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, but then the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, the Superior Court, the Civilian Oversight Court, didn't grant on that particular issue. So our position is it's preserved. It was raised in the record, but because it wasn't granted on that particular issue, we have still exhausted.
So you sought relief on that issue, and the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces did not agree to hear that issue. Is that what you're saying?
Within its discretion under Article 67 of the UCMJ. Yes, Judge, that is correct.
Okay, so what document would it be? You don't have to give me a particular page, but what document would it show that you, in fact, sought relief on that issue?
It would be what's called the supplement for a petition to review, Your Honor. Okay. And that was under previous counsel, and it would have been filed with the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. So the lower court, the Article I Military Tribunal, caught and identified 2 constitutional and jury instruction errors. Again, that the mistake of fact instruction should have been granted based upon the evidence adduced. However, it was not granted. Secondly, they agreed, the Article I Military Tribunal agreed, that propensity evidence to prove charged conduct with equally charged conduct, both of which an accused is presumed innocent, was unconstitutional because it reduces and dilutes the burden of presumption of innocence and the idea that the government has to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt for each and every offense. But the other 2 jury instruction cases that the Article I Military Tribunal, which shows that the review was neither adequate, full, nor fair, are these. Subsumed within the mistake of fact instruction and nowhere to be found in the Article I Tribunal's review is the second instruction that goes with the mistake of fact instruction, which places the burden on the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the mistake of fact did not exist. The jury was never instructed on that either. So we have a complete defense to all charged offenses and the burden shift placing the prosecution on notice with its requirement to disprove the mistake of fact, neither of which made it to the deliberation room, and no relief was granted for that, even though that's constitutional magnitude.
Did the court consider that? Well, the court did consider that because that's the way the court placed that burden, right? So that was evaluated specifically by the court.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. The answer is partially. Here's why. The Article I Military Tribunal said that the mistake of fact instruction should have issued, but nowhere in its opinion does it discuss the corollary in the second part of the mistake of fact instruction, which also should have issued, which shifts the burden back to the prosecution to carry the day by proof beyond a reasonable doubt to disprove the mistake of fact. And the consequence of that is counsel can't stand before the jury and say, a moment ago, Her Honor just instructed that if this client reasonably and honestly believed that consent occurred, the prosecution had the duty to disprove that. That dynamic never happened, which is a fundamental component of criminal trial law.
Quick question. Did the ACCA use the proper harmless error test for a constitutional error? And did you argue that the harmless error test for constitutional error is different from harmless error outside of that?
I understand your question correctly. Yes. The Article I Military Tribunal used the harmless error test. They cited it correctly, but they concluded, Your Honor, which is why we claim that the analysis is inadequate under Article I, that they can see no scenario where if the mistake of fact instruction were issued, that the outcome would have been different. And that, to me, and to I would hope reasonable jurists, defies logic. The issue is there was 13 points of evidence to include the accused testifying in his own behalf that raised and justifies issuance of the instruction. And then without that instruction, the jury has no idea that they can consider the evidence of consent as bearing on a full and complete acquittal. That's the prejudice and harmless error. But in a short sentence, the ACCA, the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, the Article I Military Tribunal, they just made short work of it saying we can see no outcome. And I believe that defies logic and experience.
But let me pull back for a second on this corollary point about the shifting of the burden. Was that briefed thoroughly before the ACCA?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. Yes, okay. It was. Rule for court-martial 916.
All right. Well, what do we say then about Watson in terms of full and fair consideration? If you brief the issue, therefore the issue was before the Army, the ACCA, and they issued a decision which was more than a few summary lines, then why shouldn't we conclude that there is full and fair consideration of it? I mean, it's not that the court wasn't aware of this argument. I mean, the two prongs of the argument as you outlined it here. Mm-hmm. So why isn't that full and fair consideration for purposes of the limited review that has been defined by our case law, and specifically Watson, please?
Well, Watson sets a floor, Your Honor, and I think that's a fine question. And Watson sets a floor. The case law also tells us that depending upon the severity of the constitutional issues, depending upon how they speak to the cornerstone of whether or not a fundamentally fair trial was conducted, the strength of those factors, the Dotson factors, informs courts in this circuit that they should reach the merits. So there are indeed lines of cases where the constitutional errors claimed may not rise to those substantial constitutional questions free of factual issues where there's no military involvement. And the full and fair consideration, I point to Monk. Monk is cited briefly. We rely on it heavily in our papers. This circuit in Monk had one jury instruction. And briefly, by way of background, this court ordered remand, reversal, and immediate release of the prisoner who was convicted of strangling his wife because the jury instruction, only one of them, equated reasonable doubt with substantial doubt, and then placed the burden of explaining what reasonable doubt is as a willingness to act rather than a hesitation to act. And on that singular basis alone, this court in Monk said, under the Dotson factors, this is such a severe, substantial question of constitutional law that pervaded and injected prejudice into this proceeding, we cannot be confident that this jury got the right vote because it was not properly instructed. So
on the Monk, though, what concerns me about that line of argument is that Monk was less than explicit as to why it deemed it to be appropriate in that particular case to move from a full and fair consideration line of reasoning to exactly look at the merits in that case. And so, I mean, it's hard for me to see, and I looked at it again last night. It seems to me it's hard to see how one can build an argument on Monk. I mean, what line of Monk tells you that we should be in the business of evaluating the weight of the constitutional issue, one? Two, what sort of principle line is there to draw on that? I mean, we sit there and we say, oh, well, you know, this is substantial enough, so I guess we'll look at this one, but we won't look at another one. I thought the full and fair consideration line of paradigm is designed to get us out of that business. I'll stop there. Please respond.
Yes, Judge. I think that the full and fair discussion in McCotter and in Lips and the various cases, especially Dotson, that is not an impediment to jurisdiction. That's in a guide to inform the court whether or not to reach the merits. And in these particular cases, in the Tenth Circuit, if we look at Monk, Dotson, Wallace, Day, Medrano, Lundy, relying on Callie versus Callaway from the Fifth Circuit, Burns v. Wilson from the Supreme Court, and Kahn v. Hart. Those are nine instances where this court looked at cases saying, you know what? It's the non-delegation doctrine. That's a constitutional magnitude. We've got to address that.
That doesn't answer the question of what is the principal basis for us to make that step now. And what I mean by that is one can say, sure, I look at Monk, I look at Dotson, and I say, yes, we went to the merits, but we're less than transparent. And that's not a criticism, but it seems to me a fact. We're less than transparent on why we took the additional step. And what I'm saying is, I'm not suggesting there's a jurisdictional limit here. Mm-hmm. I'm just suggesting, why do we have to? I mean, if it's a full and fair consideration, why do we have to do that? And frankly, as a general matter, doesn't the full and fair consideration paradigm suggest that we shouldn't do it in most cases?
Well, I agree with the latter part of your question, Judge. However, I disagree with the former part of it. And here's why. Each of the factors and the case law informs, it's a sliding scale. Every case that presents a constitutional question of constitutional magnitude can be evaluated by a three-judge panel of the Tenth Circuit and determine whether or not the line of demarcation, if I understand your question correctly, is how severe, how did it inject into the proceedings, whether or not we as reasonable jurists can determine whether or not this accused received a fair trial.
Okay, then let me see if I understand the sort of mode of methodology that you're contemplating. We're, as a general matter, we're looking at whether there was full and fair consideration by the Honorable Article I Court. However, even if we found that there was full and fair consideration, we look over on this side and we say, well, wow, this is a constitutional issue of significant magnitude. Therefore, we think it takes an Article III lens to look at it. Is that the paradigm, or where am I missing that?
Sir, that is the paradigm, because it's a sliding scale. Like you mentioned, there is those cases that don't reach the fundamental cornerstone of due process, the fundamental cornerstone of traditional notions of fair play, to make sure that an American soldier with no previous record receives a fair trial. And having four jury instructions that are incorrect leaves an underinformed, misinformed, and confused jury such that we can't be sure that the verdict was evaluated with the proper standard. The significance
okay,
is...
Let me fast forward here, and this is only a hypothetical. Given this paradigm that you're alluding to, how can we either err or not err in making our determination? In other words, I'm looking at the petition for rehearing down the road. Let's assume we rule against you and we say, well, we're going to just do full and fair consideration. In light of what you said, how can you claim that we did anything wrong? I mean, because there is no principle basis to evaluate whether we did anything wrong. Why is one issue, what is the objective criteria that makes one issue substantial as opposed to another?
Because a young man was incarcerated without due process of law, Judge. That's the substantial issue on four jury instructions.
That will pretty much always be the case.
But at the same time, if you look at the line of cases within the 10th Circuit, I see that I'm over my time, but I'd like to answer the question with your permission. And if you look at the line of cases, some of the constitutional issues don't strike to the heart of whether or not the trial was fair, or don't deprive or undermine the presumption of innocence, or don't allow an accused to put on a complete defense. In this case, you have four examples where he was deprived of putting on his defenses. The burden of the prosecution was diluted to preponderant evidence. The prosecutor used preponderant evidence to say you can convict in preponderant evidence. I don't know how more substantial or severe this constitutional issues could be. So right. I believe that's the benchmark.
I would just, for you may not have any rebuttal, although Judge Holmes might grant you some, but Monk, I noticed, predated Watson and Dodson. And so my question, if you come back at all, is did Watson and Dodson abrogate the prior precedent, or is the fact that it predated it not a concern for you? But you won't have time to argue that.
He can answer it now if you're inclined.
All right. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors. Yes, I'm happy to answer that. Because of the predate, 1990, I believe, is when Dodson came out, as well as Monk. Those two cases, the test is still the same. There might be a little change in language from full to fair to inadequate, but inadequate can be traced to the Burns v. Wilson Supreme Court case. You have to show how the Article I military tribunal was inadequate to resolve the constitutional claims. And this court, sitting as the final arbiters of the law, when you have four jury instructions that so contaminated the trial such that the jury came back and said, we want a clarification, we can't be confident that the accused received a conviction because of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, especially when the prosecutor and the judge are saying the standard of evidence is preponderance rather than beyond a reasonable doubt. That is substantial because it speaks to the bedrock of fundamental fairness of American constitutional law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Justice Holmes.
Ms. Mack.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Jared Mack on behalf of the Commandant of the Disciplinary Barracks. Judge Holmes, I want to answer your question specifically. If you look at supplemental appendix pages 40 and 50, you'll see the actual issues that were raised by the defense before ACCA. They raised the propensity argument. The mistake of fact issue really was not something that was looked at. They raised issues of sufficiency of the evidence and the propensity arguments. And that may in large part be, if you look at supplemental appendix page 13, which is the opinion in this case, you'll notice that, in fact, the court gave mistake of fact instructions with respect to sexual assault and forcible sodomy. And when you tie that issue to the fact that the court ultimately reversed the conviction on the sex assault because they thought it was multiplicitous of rape, the instructions for mistake of fact really were something that was largely not challenged under the circumstances. And so the issue
if it wasn't challenged, then you may lose kind of the assumption that we don't review ACCA on the merits if something was fairly raised. That would then switch you to an alternative defense, which is okay, maybe we don't get the Watson and Dodson presumptions, but if it wasn't raised, not exhausted. But I don't think you raised a non-exhaustion issue, did you?
Judge Bell, we did not. It was not an issue that we addressed at all in our briefings as to whether or not the mistake of fact, because
So aren't you arguing against yourself then if you didn't raise failure to exhaust and you're acknowledging that at least one of these issues may not have been really raised doesn't that take you out of the protection of Watson and Dodson?
I don't think it takes us out of the protection of those particular cases, because the court is left, again, it gets back to the larger question that counsel was raising as to what the role of this court really is, as to whether or not it sits to review substantial issues of constitutional law. And in this case, the question before the court is whether or not those jury instructions raised substantial issues of constitutional law.
And I would, Mr. Mack, could I just ask a quick procedural question? I want to make sure I understood you. Okay. Were you you alluded to ACCA in talking about this whole question of what was raised, the mistake of fact issue. My question to opposing counsel went to what was raised before the Army, the Court of Appeals of Armed Forces. What is your view on whether they raised that issue before the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces?
So, Judge Holmes, if you look at supplemental appendix pages 86, the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces issues really centered on a much larger universal question about whether or not certain judges had authority to sit. When you look at supplemental appendix page 92, you see the gross defense arguments about whether or not the court erred in applying the Hills case. The evidence was not legally sufficient, and the prosecution engaged in prejudicial arguments. Those were the issues that counsel raised before CAF under the circumstances. But to answer your question candidly, Judge Bell, we did not raise any issues with respect to any issues of waiver or forfeiture of those arguments.
Okay, let's just go back one more time. I'm a little uncertain about the relative importance that we give to ACCA versus the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces. Judge Holmes touched on that, and it just reminded me that I'm not terribly clear on that. In applying the question of Dodson and Watson and what was raised before a court and whether we can look at it or should look at it, it's not jurisdictional. Should we focus primarily on ACCA or on the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces?
For purposes of, let me answer this way. The Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces sits as a discretionary panel. They do not have to grant a petition for hearing coming out of ACCA, but at times they do. In this case, the issue that they raised had nothing to do with the underlying questions before this court. It had to do with the jurisdictional issue with respect to whether or not the judge had authority to sit.
You said that the which court were you saying had only the question of the jurisdiction?
The Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces.
Okay.
The Superior
Court.
So we
are focusing in this case, we're focusing on ACCA.
Correct.
But Mr. Mag, am I correct that if you do not raise to the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces an issue, you cannot then go to federal court on that issue, whether they take it or not, which is a discretionary decision?
Correct. Our position, Judge Holmes, is largely the same as an issue, say, in 2254 cases. If a litigant fails to appeal the issue to the state's highest court, they've essentially forfeited or waived that issue. We have argued in multiple briefs coming out of the disciplinary barracks that a military service member who fails to appeal to CAF the exact issue raised in the briefs before the Article III court, they have in fact waived that issue for failure to properly exhaust.
Okay. And so irrespective of whether CAF takes it, they need to raise it.
That is the government's position.
That's the government's position. Okay. But we can get to your merits argument, you haven't raised any exhaustion or waiver issue here.
No, we did not raise that issue before the court.
Okay. All right. Please go ahead.
So I think the critical question really is demonstrated in Judge Longstrom's statement at the end of his findings at the appendix at page 63. He says it's not the legal issue of whether the instructions were proper that is in dispute. It's the application of those findings to the evidentiary record that's the core of the argument. And that really, I think, settles the issue here, because a substantial constitutional question, and Judge Bell, I think you touched on this, would really be if, say, ACCA applied Brecht's more forgiving, substantial, and injurious effect standard of review rather than Chapman's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So in that instance, if ACCA had applied Brecht versus Abramson rather than Chapman, I think the court could review something like that because that is a substantial constitutional error on the part of the reviewing court because they applied the wrong harmless error standard. But what we have here really is just some arguments over the impact of jury instructions that nobody disputes were given in error. And ACCA did exactly what it was supposed to do, was look at the record under Article 66 of the UMCJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice, UCMJ, and determine whether or not, based upon harmless error, the defendant's or the petitioner's case should be reversed. So they did exactly what they were supposed to do. Essentially, what counsel is asking this court to do is sit in the exact same position as ACCA. And that really, if you look very closely at the argument, is what they want this court to do.
But so going back to what Judge Holmes said, you are conceding, I guess, I think admirably, that a substantial constitutional error, if it's a pure law and it's really substantial, can still be reviewed by us. So that harkens back to the pre-Watson and Dodson cases, which have never, the pre-ones, I don't believe were ever explicitly overturned or overruled or said are no longer valid authority, except that they seem to be a different approach. So you are saying that in a case of substantial constitutional error, we can still reach the merits, but you're not giving us any test, and your opponent didn't give us any test of how we decide what is a substantial constitutional error.
Correct. And I think that, Judge, to direct you to, I think the more relevant case on that issue is Roberts versus Callahan, where the court really did a deep dive and critical inquiry into what the four Dodson factors are and how they apply. Now, remember in Monk, the constitutional question there was the reasonable doubt instruction, which certainly raised a significant issue, which is a very universal question about how a jury is instructed on reasonable doubt. And so to that degree, the court in Monk believed that that was a substantial constitutional question with which it needed to address.
Mr. Mag, can I just tease out a point from that I at least understand from your argument, which is essentially Judge Ebel's line of questioning has been talking about what appears to be a tension between Watson and Dodson and Monk and some prior cases that went before Watson and Dodson. What I understood you to say by virtue of Judge Lundstrom's point is that even if we should derive some guidance from Monk on looking at substantial constitutional questions, that this is not that case. In other words, we could say, oh, there's a substantial constitutional question, therefore we should go look at it. This isn't a case where there is such a question because everybody agrees there was error in the instruction. So the only question is harmlessness or not. Am I understanding at least one corollary of what you're saying?
Judge, that's spot on. That is exactly the issue before the court, because the only constitutional question at play here is whether or not ACCA properly applied the harmless error standard. And again, that's important to understand, to look at it in the context of what this court would have to do if it sat in judgment as the same situation that ACCA did. You would have to engage in the harmless error analysis. You would not do anything different. You would look at the application of Chapman in the harmless error analysis under the circumstances to reach the constitutional question, which is exactly what ACCA did. In a sort of corollary way, this is not too different than AEDPA, when the courts are looking to determine whether or not the state courts have given proper application. I'm not saying that AEDPA applies here, but I think when you look at it in the context of what a court does to review a state court's determination of whether or not it properly and faithfully applied constitutional law. The question is whether or not this court believes that it did that. And there isn't anything in this case that would suggest that ACCA, you know, misapplied the Chapman standard in looking at it. And the court, again, has to look at the very sweeping powers that that ACCA has under Article 66 of the UCMJ. Remember, they're looking at everything. And then largely are sitting again as the jury in the case to determine whether or not there were any errors under the circumstances. So their authority is so broad in trying to determine what was justified by the trial court and whether or not there was error. And I think the court should not overlook that under the circumstances. So I think it's important to realize what ACCA's authority is when it is reviewing a case.
Counsel, can I just jump in here really quickly? Then what is your argument on the four prongs of the Dodson test? I mean, in what order do we look at them? Do we say first look at the military courts failed to give adequate consideration, or do we ask whether there's a substantial constitutional question?
Right. So Judge, if you look at Roberts versus Callahan, and we go into great depth about this in our response, about how to apply the four factors, and the court sort of looked at, you know, exactly what your question was about the process. And, you know, the court concluded that the four factors are guiding principles, that it's not a sort of dual track process where you look at whether or not there was full and fair consideration and a substantial constitutional question. It's all subsumed in the process of guiding the court through the four factors. And I don't believe that the court said that you have to sort of take a very sort of clinical approach of checking the box of 1, 2, 3, 4. In this case, of course, you're looking at whether or not first there's at all a substantial constitutional question. At its core, Dodson even says the fourth factor is the most critical factor under all circumstances, no matter what you're looking at, because this court is only going to sit for substantial constitutional errors. And that's clear. I mean, that's been clear since Burns, because the Congress and the courts have been very clear about saying that Article III courts are really not to get into a situation of significant interference with the military courts. So to look at the process, again, I think Roberts versus Callahan, I think really, and I would submit, really answers the question here about the process itself, that all the four factors really are combined as a guiding tool rather than checking the box under the circumstances. And I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. You, Mr. Maher, you had significant time beyond. I just to make sure that you have... leave your feeling you were heard. 30 seconds if you want to take it in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Much obliged. I will try to speak quickly. When it comes to the standard to apply to whether or not this court should reach the merits under the full and fair consideration prong of the Dodson factors, I believe the standard is a sliding scale. And if you have multiple constitutional errors that are free from facts that speak directly to the fundamental fairness of a trial that the Article I tribunal did not address, which is the case here. They never addressed the prosecution urging the jury to use preponderance of the evidence. They never addressed the prosecution diluting the standard of proof to preponderance of the evidence. And they never addressed how the jury's deliberations can be muddled with the conflicting standards of review. And I see that my time is up.
All right.
May I ask one quick question? Just very quickly, did the ACCA, when it judged harmless error here, that the error was harmless, did it use a cumulative test of all the error combined was harmless?
No, Judge.
Look at it separately.
No, Judge. In artificial isolation, as the case law uses that term, each error was considered in artificial isolation rather than what the case law counsels in toto to determine.
So ACCA never used an aggregate harmless error analysis.
Correct, Judge.
Did you argue specifically that harmless error, did your client argue that the harmless error analysis had to include an aggregate analysis?
Yes, Judge, we did in our opening papers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsels. Thank you for the arguments. Case is submitted.